Hi, my name's Damien. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Damien.
I want to thank Jake for asking me to speak wherever he went, and Swacky Paw. Before Swacky Paw was around, it was Salty Paw, and I served on the committee for about a year, year and a half, something like that. And I really like what they do, what the YPAW groups do for young people in Alcoholics Anonymous, because when I was young and I came in, if I was young when I came in, I would have really needed this younger crowd. Even coming in at 30 years old, I needed this younger crowd. It made me feel more comfortable. I hope I can be appropriate. I got, you know, I've been told sometimes when I tell my story, I scare some people. I hope I can turn it down a couple notches. Before I got sober, you know, I thought my problem wasn't drinking, it wasn't drugs. You know, I thought it was getting the cops off my back. You know, I thought if they left me alone, if the police would leave me alone, if the judges wouldn't lock me up, if my probation officer wasn't such a dick, that I could live a good life. You know, and I thought that for a long time. I got into Alcoholics Anonymous because my life wasn't really working out for me, and I ran out of options. I got backed into a corner, and I was on my way back to prison, and I was scared, and I didn't know what else to do. All the options that I had were gone, you know, and what happened was I got ordered to go to a rehab. And in that rehab, I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. And since that day, I've been sober and I've been able to maintain and live a pretty good life. And my sobriety date is November 1st of 2008. It's my actual birthday, too. I got sober on my 30th birthday. The last time I drank, the last time I used, it was wasn't like the, you know, nothing bad happened. It was just kind of a trip, you know. It was just kind of like one of those days that I used to always wish I would have, you know, when I'd drink and when I'd use. Like, I used to, like, think about it. I'm like, today I'm going to go to the bar, and I'm going to dance with some girls, and I'm going to have a good time, and I'm not going to go to jail, and I'm not going to get arrested, and I'm not going to beat anybody up. Like, five times out of ten, I'd end up in jail, I'd end up beating somebody up, and I'd end up doing something I really regretted, and it just got to that point with me, and it had been to that point for a lot of years. I just couldn't accept it. When I started drinking, I was pretty young. I think I developed like the craving like at a really, really young age. I grew up Catholic and I was an altar boy, and so I used to help clean up after church and stuff like that, and we drank. As Catholics, we drink wine, and I'd sneak off like after everybody had left the church, and I'd duck behind a pew and I'd down some wine, and I wouldn't down enough to get drunk, but I downed enough because like that feeling that it filled me up with, like that warm, real good, like fuzzy feeling, you know, I just really enjoyed it, you know. And the first time I got drunk with one of my cousins. He fell asleep, and for some reason I got pissed off because of that, and I beat him up while he was sleeping. And that kind of pattern just followed my whole alcohol use. You know, I just became a dick, and I was a violent, violent alcoholic. I remember being in middle school, and I always tell this story because it kind of explains what alcohol did for me. When I was in middle school, you know, I'd sit at the dances, and I'd watch people dance, you know. And back then, I grew up in the 90s, and like MC Hammer and Vanilla Ice was popping, you know, and Criss Cross, and I just really loved those guys. And people they'd get in circles and they'd dance, you know, and they'd like break dance, and they could get down, and I wanted so bad just to kind of jump in there and show them what I could do. And I knew I liked to dance because when I wasn't at the dances, I was at home in my room with the door closed, dancing in front of the mirror, you know, to some Vanilla Ice, and I'd be like, next dance, I'm going to show them all what's up. You know, I'm going to do the worm. And And what I'd do is I'd end up sitting there the whole time thinking, I gotta do this. Man, if I do this, I'll be so cool. And then those other thoughts would come in. If I do this, I'm gonna embarrass myself. If I do this, people are gonna look at me weird. So I'd never do it. Like, that fear always crept in and always outweighed the other stuff. And then I discovered, like, the effects of alcohol. You know, I remember it was a Halloween, around Halloween time, because we were at a Halloween party, and I stole some mini bottles from my mom and dad, and me and my friends were drinking them, and I felt that, like, you know, I could do anything, you know, I could do anything, and what I did is I, like, danced, and I, like, was cool, and I did all those things that I used to let the fear get in the way of. So what alcohol did for me is it took away the fear. You know, it made me that person that I wanted to be. I didn't think about what you thought of me. I didn't think about what those other kids were thinking. And the girls were digging it, you know. ever since I was like a young kid, you know, I was always into the girls and I wanted them to like me. I was just too afraid of them. And when I drink alcohol, you know, I could swoop right up in and be like, hey, what's up? You know, and for real, man, it made me so relaxed. And I didn't really start to experience real severe consequences until I was 16. What happened was I went to school drunk. You know, and I'd been to school a few times drunk, and I got arrested, you know. I got arrested, and I picked up a bunch of charges, and it was the same thing, you know. If they wouldn't have messed with me, if they wouldn't have bothered me, if they would just let me do what I'm doing, you know, this wouldn't be a problem. What happened, by the time I was 18 years old, I had developed a drug habit. I was doing a lot of meth. I was doing a lot of cocaine. I was drinking a lot, and I was doing whatever else was on the table. And I started experiencing, like, pretty low lows with each of the drugs. You know, I was high on meth, and I accidentally shot myself, paranoid that people were after me. And so I went to go pull my gun on the people that weren't there that I thought was after me, and accidentally shot myself. I almost blew, like, my gun was right there. my gun was right there, so I almost really did some damage. And I was sitting in the hospital, you know, after I'd been up for a long time, a couple weeks, and I'm sitting in the hospital, and I got my family there, and a girlfriend that I was seeing, and my grandma. My grandma was probably, like, in her late 80s around this time. She's a little Mexican lady, and she kind of speaks broken up English, and she looked down at me, and she called me her hijito. She goes, mijito. She goes, promise me that you'll never do those drugs again. And I looked up at her from that hospital bed with a bullet hole in me, you know, and I looked up at her, and I like had a blank stare, like, why would I promise you something like that? You know, they're good. You know, drugs are good. You know, if you only knew. And I think what happened was, like, my mom, my dad, my grandma, and everybody in my family, they always knew. They always knew what I was going to end up doing. And they tried to protect me from that. And they tried to save me from becoming the person I became. And they went to drastic measures. You know, they stuck me in a rehab. They wasn't sure what was going on with me, because I'd have these outlashes of anger, and I couldn't, like, I was drinking, and I'd disappear, and I was getting in trouble, and one time, they brought some people in, and they were, I don't know what kind of people these people were, but they had me lay down on this bed, and they started talking in tongues, and they were, like, trying to exorcise demons out of me. And my mom, you know, I could imagine if my mom and dad went to that length to try to help me, you know, they must have really thought I was screwed. And they constantly try to save me. You know, they constantly try to help me. They constantly try to protect me. I heard somebody in a meeting, or I think it was on a speaker tape, say one time that my family, all they ever did was love me. They tried to love me in the right direction. And every time they loved me, I punished them for it. And that's what I was doing to my mom and dad. They loved me more than anybody. And when they tried to constrain me, when they tried to punish me, when they tried to protect me, that's what was in their heart. That was their true meaning behind it all, is they wanted to keep me safe. I punished them for it. You know, I punished them with FUs. I punished them with my violence. I punished them with getting in trouble. And when I got sober, you know, that was the biggest regrets I had. To be honest with you, when I first got sober, I didn't think I deserved it. and to think I deserved it because of the stuff I did to my mom and my dad, you know, and some other people in the community. By the time I was 18 years old, I'd been kicked out of every school I've been to, hurt everybody I've been involved in my life. I'd picked up numerous charges. I experienced with all the drugs. I'd gotten in a motorcycle accident being drunk, the cops estimated going 110 and 130 miles an hour. I was life-led to the hospital and almost killed me. And I left that hospital, and within a week, I was drinking again. I shot myself on meth, and I was tweaking again within a few weeks. And when I was 18 years old, I still should have been in high school because I have a late birthday. And I picked up my first felony charges as an adult. And when I was 19 years old, I got sent to the Utah State Prison. One of the most defining moments in my life was the day I got sent to prison. I remember sitting in the courtroom. And I remember standing in front of that judge. And I remember that judge telling me that he thought I was a threat to society. And then he sentenced me to 0 to 5 years in the Utah State Prison. And as soon as he said that, "I sentence you, Mr. Trujillo, to 0 to 5 years in the Utah State Prison," I heard a yell. You know, I heard a yell from behind me. And it was my mom screaming in like pain because she had just lost her son. You know, I was 19 years old, still a kid, you know, like 145 pounds. And, you know, you hear the stories about prison. I can imagine the stuff that she was going through her mind. It was going through my mind. I was like, I got to protect this, you know. And, goal number one, you know. And I spent the next 5 years in and out of prison. I'd get to prison, I'd make these convictions, you know, like when I get out of here, I'm going to change my life. I'd write letters to my mom and my dad and tell them, express to them how much I loved them and how much they meant to me and how much my life meant to me. And that when I got out of prison, I was going to make a change and I was going to do something different and I was going to live a good life. I was going to get a job. I was going to go to school. And I had all these convictions, you know, of being this person, basically to make my mom and dad proud of me, because that's all I really wanted. You know, I wanted them to be proud of me, and I wanted to have a good life too. And I get out of prison, and I start walking the streets. And then I'd last a little while, a couple weeks, a couple months, or whatever. And I'd be doing things right, you know. And eventually, little things would start to happen. I'd start hanging out with some people. I'd start allowing other things to happen, like crime, selling drugs, you know, stealing things, lying, cheating, you know. And before I knew it, I was back in prison, thinking, "How the fuck did I end up here? And what happened? You know, I made those promises. How come I can't commit to them?" And so I make those same promises again. I'm going to change. I'm going to do something different. I'm going to have a good life. And I write my mom and dad, and they believe me, and I believe me. And I get out, and I do it all again. And I end up right back in that same prison cell. They told me when I went to prison, if you write your name on the wall, that you're going to come back to see it. You know, the first time I went, I wrote my name all over the walls. And the second time I went back and I looked for my name so I could erase them. So, because I didn't want to go back. And, you know, my life was a chaotic mess. It was a chaotic mess. I was wrapped up in this whirlwind and I didn't know how to stop doing what I was doing. I was 23 or 24 when I got out of prison, and I terminated my sentence. And so I left prison a free man. The day after I got out, I was at the strip club, drinking, watching strippers and doing cocaine off the toilet, you know? And I thought, you know, this is it. This is the good life, you know. And it's what I'd always wanted. You know, I just kind of wanted to be free. I wanted to be left alone. And for a little bit, I had that. And I met a girl. I fell in love with a girl. This girl that I met, she had a little boy. His name's Shaden. Shaden was 2 years old when we got together. And I stayed with this girl for 6 years, you know, off and on. Shaden's dad wasn't around, and eventually I said I'd step up and play that role as dad, you know, and this little boy would call me dad, you know, and I ended up falling in love with this kid and this girl, and all I wanted to do was be there for them, you know. I wanted to have that relationship probably more than anything. And what happened was I kept getting in trouble by her. You know, she'd tell me, "If you continue to drink, if you continue to do this, I'm not going to be with you." And I'd make her these promises, and I'd say I was going to quit, and I'd say I was going to do something different. And then I wouldn't, and she'd leave me. you know, I think I make it pretty apparent in my life. You know, I couldn't see it then, but it didn't really matter what I put in front of me or what I had in front of me. You know, I had my probation, I had my parole, I had years of going back to prison. And if I would stop drinking, if I'd stop using drugs, if I'd stop committing crimes, if I'd stop hanging out with some certain people, I could be free. I could live a good life. And I could never do any of that, you know. All I really wanted eventually was to have that girl and have that relationship, and I knew what I had to do to have it, and I couldn't do it. You know, I couldn't do it. I couldn't keep her. Things were getting crazy. You know, she had left me. My mind was out of control. I was doing a lot of cocaine, a lot of meth, and I was drinking a lot. And I used to rotate my drugs and my drinking because I'd start getting trouble with drinking. So I'd be like, well, I got to start doing some cocaine. And then I'd start, like, being too paranoid. So I'd be like, well, I should start doing some meth. And then I'd go back to that. Then I'd go back to the alcohol, and I'd cycle these things, like, every few months. And none of it would work for me. You know, it was bullshit. My mind was really going, you know, it was gone. And, I had come up with a solution of, to stay out on the streets. You know, I was sick of the cops locking me up, and I was sick of them locking my friends up, and I needed to do something different. And, so I developed this plan in my head, you know, because I grew up, I was a gangster, you know, I used to carry guns and I'd shoot at people and I'd do stuff like that. And I was kind of crazy, you know, and I was down to do some pretty serious stuff. And so I was like, well, I told my friends, I was like, I got this plan. We're going to do this. And all of us are going to be free forever. And I was like, what's that? What are we going to do, Damien? And I was like, we're going to go to war against these cops, you know? We're going to all get a bunch of guns, and we're going to fight them. And they weren't down. My friends weren't down to do this thing. And I was like dead serious and set on it. And that was my solution. You know, that was the only solution that I could come up with. And what happened was things started getting, like, really crazy. I had gone to a bar. I'd gotten in a fight at the bar, and I'd got kicked out of the bar, and I ended up walking, and I hated walking, and by this time, if it had been like this for a long time, when I drank, I automatically started craving cocaine or meth. Like, I'd have two beers, and that craving would kick in. Like, I gotta get high, and I'd do anything to go grab that dope. And so I stole this car. And I went out looking for this dope, and usually always I could connect. For some reason, this night I couldn't connect. I was driving around in the stolen car, going from house to house, looking to kind of get right. You know, I just needed to get right. And what happened is I blew through this red light, and there was an undercover cop sitting on the other side of the light, and they flipped on their lights, and I'm in the stolen car, and I'm an ex-convict, and one of the biggest fears, I think, for ex-convicts is to go back to prison. And I was like, I'm not going back. And so instead of pulling over, I threw it, I shifted gears and fucking went on a chase. And before I knew it, my tires were spiked, you know, and they had me pitted. You know, they hit me from every direction, and it made it so the car wouldn't go. And then they surrounded me, and all these cops had their guns drawn on me, and they were telling me, get out of the car, put your hands up. And I was sitting in this car with my hands on the steering wheel thinking, what the, you know, I remember thinking, you know, what the fuck, you know. And then I came up with this plan. I was like, I know what I'm going to do. I decided I was going to have these cops shoot me. So I stood up and I started yelling at him, and I stuck my hands in my pants and I pretended like I had a gun. And then I got hit. and then I got drug out of the car. And what happened was they didn't shoot me. They tasered me. And I probably wished I would have got shot, you know, because it hurt. And I had all these charges, and I was back in jail, and I was expecting to go to prison for a really long time. And I remember it was like the day after I arrived in jail, my mom, I think it was my brother, and my ex-girlfriend came to visit me. And my mom told me, she's like, Damien, your grandma's like 95 or 94 or something at this time. And she told me, she goes, we really want her to come visit you. because because when you go to prison, she's not going to be able to, because the prison visitation's hard to get approved. And I said, by the time you get out of here, your grandma's going to be dead. And I remember it cut me, you know, it cut me. And I remember thinking, you know, that was one of the first moments in my life I started putting two and two together, that maybe it wasn't the cops, and maybe it wasn't all that other bullshit. Maybe it was because I had a problem. Maybe it was because I couldn't stop drinking, I couldn't stop doing drugs. And I'm like 29 years old at this time, and I've been arrested 100 times, and I've hit thousands of bottoms that should have stopped me. You know, they'd stopped most people that I know, and it wasn't enough. Somehow I ended up getting off on the charges. I ended up getting on probation. And then I ended up violating my probation. I ended up sitting in front of my probation officer thinking that for sure this time it was it. This time I was going to prison. And for the first time in my life, I sat in front of another person, somebody that I used to consider the enemy, a cop, you know, and I told them that I had a problem. You know, I told them I needed help. That's the first time in my life I'd ever gone to that length. And I begged him, you know, give me a chance. I need some help. And he told me, for some reason, I don't know why, because I had a lot of, like, bad POs that would have sent me to prison like that. You know, not really bad POs, but POs that were just quick to send me to prison. And this guy told me, he goes, Damien, get into a rehab. He goes, I'm not going to guarantee you anything. He goes, but get into a rehab and we'll see what happens. And so I got funded to get into a treatment center. I got county funded, and I was on this long waiting list. And sometime, this is where I think I first really started grasping my step one. Last time I drank and the last time I used, I drank and I did a little bit of cocaine. And then for some reason, after that day, I didn't drink and I didn't use anymore. And it still took me another 2 months to get into that treatment center. And what happened was I got scared, and I started thinking, if I drink, you know, I might not make it into that rehab. That's the cycle that I started producing. Like, I couldn't control what happened to me as soon as I put that drink inside my body. As soon as I put that drug inside my body, I couldn't control what the outcome was going to be. And my life depended on me not drinking, me not going to prison, you know. And so for some reason, and I got to believe that it's some kind of higher power intervened in my life, stepped in and helped me through the next couple months. And then I landed into that treatment center, and like my step two first came into play then too. I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And that power was that rehab. You know, I kind of believed that if I got into this rehab, if I could just make it in there, you know, maybe I don't have to go to prison anymore. Maybe I can stop hurting my mom and dad. Maybe I can make some changes in my life that are beneficial to me and my family. Maybe I can do this thing. I came to believe, you know, that treatment center was going to help me. And then I got to that treatment center, and that's kind of where my step three first came into play. I turned my will and my life over to the care of that treatment center. I let them work magic on me. I let them do their, you know, use their tools. And what happened was I was receptive to it. They'd tell me to do this, and I'd do this. They'd tell me to do that, and I'd do that. And a lot of it didn't make sense. You know, I didn't know why I was doing some of the stuff that I was doing. But I knew that other people had said it worked. You know, in that treatment center, they introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous. We had meetings like 6 days a week there. And I listened to people that were sharing in those meetings, and I started like identifying with them. I started hearing my story, and like that step two came in again. I started believing that a power greater than myself, Alcoholics Anonymous, was going to help me. I started believing that these people in these meetings that had been through the same stuff that I'd been through were going to help me. And so what I did is I was told I needed to get a sponsor. I was told that I needed to get a sponsor before I left that treatment center. So I got a sponsor. And when I got out of that treatment center, I started working with that sponsor. I started doing the steps. And I started making some changes in my life. And to be honest with you, it was hard. You know, it was hard. I'm the kind of person that gives up. I'm the kind of person when things get hard, I give up. I turn to a drink, I turn to a drug, or I get violent with these, you know. And that's just the way I react to things. So when things would get hard, I wouldn't know what to do. And they told me when I got here, you know, you got to call your sponsor. My sponsor told me, call me every single day. you know, and it didn't make a lot of sense. It seemed like a lot of bullshit, you know. I remember some of those phone calls, but like, what's up, bro? This is me. And he'd be like, well, hi, you. And that would be it. He'd be like, all right, call me tomorrow. I'm like, this is dumb. And I like to share this, too, because I was watching Karate Kid one time. And I was like, this is fucking Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. Mr. Miyagi is teaching fucking Daniel to do karate, and he's having him like wash his car and do all, and then paint the fence and do all this stupid bullshit stuff, and then Daniel gets all pissed off. He's like, what the fuck? I want him here to learn karate, you know. And then Mr. Miyagi gets crazy with him and starts throwing punches. He goes, show me wax the car. Fucking Daniel starts throwing like starts blocking his punches and stuff like that. And what happened with me was all the stuff that they told me to do, like my sponsor calling them every single day and working these steps and stuff like that. I was dating this girl when I was first getting sober, and you know, if you want to go through some emotional shit, do that. And what I was doing is instead of like, well, I'd still flip out, but instead of flipping out and drinking and doing going to the extent that I used to, I'd call my sponsor. You know, and it's because I was calling him every single day. I was making it a habit. I was making these changes in my life, and I was kind of got manipulated into like doing this weird stuff. And what it did is it ended up saving my life. You know, I ended up calling my sponsor. I ended up doing these steps. I ended up making these changes, and then I turned into this nice guy. You know, and my life since then has gotten extraordinary. You know, I've had some pretty cool experiences in Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to come here on, I think, was it Thursdays? Every Thursday night for like a year and a half. You know, I'd come here and there was a lot of us that would show up here, and like we'd touch down with this spirit, you know, this spirit that I never used to feel, that I wasn't sure if I ever used to believe in. We connected as a group, and I started becoming like a part of something, you know. And I never had that, you know. I had my gang, and I had my homies, and that was something different. This shit made me feel good. It made me feel part of everybody. I remember the first time I prayed. Legitimately, I was getting in a fight with that girl that I said I was first dating when I first got sober, and it was pretty bad. Like, we were both in the sober living, and she lived in the apartment below me, and I thought she was fucking all my friends, and I was pissed off about it, and I called her out on it, and then I fucking, like, one of the dudes, I called him out on it, and I was angry, and I was pissed off, and I was gonna beat somebody up, and instead, I had like a short moment of clarity, and I jumped in my car, and I took off, and I drove to my sister's house. And I remember I was like crying, you know, because those are the times, it was moments just like that, that I flip out, that I drink, and that would cause me to go to prison, you know. And instead, what I did is I drove home, and I was crying, and I was punching my steering wheel, and I got to my sister's house, and I hit my fucking knees. You know, I always heard, pray, pray, and I hit my knees, and I looked up to the ceiling, and I said, please help me stay sober through this. Please help me stay sober through this. I needed it. You know, I didn't know how to stay sober, and I asked for help, and what happened was I made it through it, and I've made it through a lot of hard times, and I've made it through a lot of good times, and I don't know how it works. You know, it's just like Karate Kid. You know, Mr. Miyagi is just telling, it just happens one day. You know, you pull this stuff out of your back pocket, you know, the stuff that they teach you to do here, the stuff they taught me to do here. And then the tools come in handy when I least expect it, you know, when I'm not really sure that's what I'm going to do. And what's happened every time, almost every time, is I've pulled those tools out of my pocket. Just recently, couple weeks ago, it was about 2 or 3 weeks ago, I had a sponsee, somebody that I was sponsoring, he hung himself, and I've gotten used to people dying in this program. I've lost a lot of friends, and I've had 5 people that I've sponsored die And when he died, like I kind of got sad about it, but then I rolled with it. And the next day I got a call about another sponsee that had died, and it kind of dropped me to my knees, and I didn't know what to do. And like all this pain and shit started filling me up. And then the next day, I had this dream. I was I was out on the ice. I was up in the mountains somewhere, and I was on this frozen lake, and the ice was kind of fragile. And there was all these puppies on this lake, and these puppies kept falling in the water. And so I'd run out to this lake, and I'd try to, like, I'd grab one of these puppies that fell in, and I'd pull it out of the ice, out of the icy water. And then as soon as I pulled that one out, another one would fall in. So I'd run over and try to grab the other one, and there was some lady there. And it was weird because I like had like a Del Taco uniform on, and I was and I was working at Del Taco, and I've never worked at Del Taco in my life. And there was this lady there that kept hitting me up about a burrito. She's like, hey, can I get that burrito? And I was trying to be nice about it. And I was like, hey, hold on, I gotta help these puppies out real quick, and then I'll get you your then I'll get you your burrito. And I'd run and I'd like start pulling these puppies out, and there's like eight of them. So every time I pull one out, another one would come up, and then I had this lady asking me for her burritos every couple minutes. And then finally I got irritated with the lady. I was like, fuck your fucking burrito, I'm trying to save some puppies. and then I ran out to the ice, and all these puppies had fallen in, you know, and I kind of knew in my dream that if I jumped in the water, I could save these puppies. You know, I could pull them all out. But I knew if I jumped in there, it was going to take me out. You know, I'd die. And my dad was at the lake, too. And I walked past my dad, and my dad's all, where are you going? And I told him, I said, I can't fucking save any of these puppies. and the way I relate it to is with the people that I sponsor. Since I've been sober, I've sponsored a lot of people. And like I said, I've had five of them that have died, you know. And then... And sometimes it gets hard, you know, sometimes it gets really hard, but I don't think I'm ever going to tell my dad that I can't save him. There's a story that I really, really love, and it's about a boy that's out on the ocean trying to save these starfish. A tide comes in and brings in a bunch of starfish, and his dad comes up and he's like, what are you doing, son? He's all, I'm trying to save these starfish, and he's throwing them back in the ocean. And the dad tells the kid, he goes, you got miles and miles of ocean to go. He goes, you'll never make a difference. The little kid picks up one of these starfish and looks at it, and he tosses it up in the air and catches it and looks at it some more. Then he grabs it and chucks it into the ocean and looks up at his dad, and he goes, I just made a difference for that one. You know, and that's kind of what Alcoholics Anonymous and like doing 12-step work's all about. You know, I've learned that I can't help everybody, but I try to give it my all. You know, I make it an important priority in my life to help people that I sponsor and help people in this program, because without this program, I wouldn't be here. I know that. I know that for a fact. You know, I'd be dead or I'd be in prison. And this program has given me my life back. It's given me this whole new fucking, this whole new way of living. You know, I went to one of the funerals of one of the guys. I went to both the funerals, but I was at one of the funerals, and I saw this guy that I was going to kill him back when I was drinking and using. I ran into him at the bar, and I told him I was going to kill him, and I probably would have killed him if he would have came outside. And I probably scared the shit out of this dude, and he was sitting right next to me at this funeral. And I turned to him, and I pulled out some Mr. Miyagi shit, you know, my ninth step, you know. And I told him, you know, I need to talk to you, man. And I told him I was sorry for the things that I did. And I told him what I'd been doing, and I asked him what I could do. And he told me, man, it sounds like you're living a pretty good life. You know, I'm happy for you. I wish I could do that. You know, and that's the shit that I get out of this program. I go to a funeral after something really bad happened, and something really bad happens, and something good comes out of it. You know, I try to make the most out of my life. I try to live a righteous life. I don't always do that. I have my faults. You know, I'm not perfect. Sometimes I still get pissed off. Sometimes I still explode. Sometimes I a lot of times I don't show up to work on time, and but for the most part, you know, I live a pretty good life. I just got accepted to the University of Utah to be a substance abuse counselor, and I'll start that this fall. I'm working on getting my bachelor's or my master's or maybe even my PhD, you know, and I'm doing things different. I work at a treatment center, and I'm happy with the way my life is going. You know, I've done this thing where I go to the Capitol and I work during the legislative session. And the first year I did, it was 2 years ago. And it was weird because coming from where I've come from and being up at the Capitol, hanging out with senators and stuff like that, sitting down with them, eating with them, and living this kind of life, you know, I wonder, like, do I really deserve this, you know? And what happened was, like, a little window of opportunity. I saw this little window of opportunity of what my life's potential is while I was up there. And I thought to myself, you know, I could do anything I want to do. I can be anybody I want to be, you know, as long as I stay sober and as long as I put this thing, this program in my life, number one, I can achieve anything I want to. And I believed it, like, with the innermost self of myself. You know, and since then I've been flying, you know, I've been doing some crazy stuff, you know, hanging out, sitting down, eating dinner with senators, telling them who I am and what I've done, working on bills and stuff like that to help people that are in recovery, you know, that for treatment. And it's been amazing, you know, it's been amazing to be able to be that person, because the person that I used to be was the kind of person that used to hurt people, you know. I have a good relationship with my mom and my dad. One of the things I'm most proud of today. My mom and my dad, they used to tell me when I first got sober that when I went to jail or when I'd get locked up, that they'd sleep good at night. And when I was out running the streets, they couldn't sleep. You know, and now they sleep good with me in the arms of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, with you guys. They love that I'm part of this program. I'll go into my mom's work. My mom works at Sam's Club. Like, I'll go in there and I'll just say what's up to my mom. And she's like a real social person. And she tells all her little homies that, she's like, this is my son and he's been sober for 4 years. And I think that's so cool. You know, I think that's so cool that my mom's proud of me. You know, my grandma, that one that came to the jail, the one that talked to me after I shot myself, she died this year. Both my grandmas died this year. And they both got to see me sober, and they both got to see me live this life. I used to go up to the Capitol, and every time I go up there, I wear a suit. And on my way home, I'd stop by my grandma's just so she could see me in my suit, you know, just so she could be proud of me. You know, and for both my grandma's funerals, they asked me to give the eulogy. You know, they wouldn't have asked me 5 years ago. Some gang-banging thug, some convict. You know, my family loves and respects me today. They love and respect the things that I do as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. As a member of Alcoholics Anonymous who works these steps. Because without that, I wouldn't have any of this. You know, I still, a couple months ago, I fired my sponsor. But I hired him. I rehired him. and I still talk to him almost on a consistent, casual basis. You know, I call him up and I talk to him about my problems. And I do my 10th and 11th steps with him. And I talk to him about who I am and what I'm doing and my faults and my rights. And I ask him for his suggestions. And I let God work in my life. I let God work in my life the most I can. And when I do that, things end up okay. When I've done that, things end up just all right. That's all I wanted. You know, I just wanted things to be all right. I don't blame the cops, the judges. You know, I don't blame anybody anymore for the life that I live or the hardships that I faced. You know, I realize now through the steps, through the process of the steps, that what I did, the things that I did, were my own doing. You know, and I never used to be able to see that. You know, that's if you can get to that point, that's one of the most freeing things the steps can give you, when you stop blaming other people and become responsible for who you are. Whether you're on drugs or whether you're drunk, you know, you're still responsible. I'm still responsible for the person I was, and I'm still responsible for the person I am, you know, with the help of a higher power that I wasn't sure if I believed in when I got here. You know, I throw my life into this program. I got this, you know, I got this as long as I keep doing this. Thanks for having me.